Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and unfortunately, Marvin is not with us today, but I can guarantee you he is out there making a positive difference in the life of some young man right now. Now, today we have a very special guest, and we have we've got a very interesting question. This is a question that I think I've been asked, and I think many of us have been asked. But the question is, what does the American dream mean anymore? And our guest today, author Bruce Ferber's funny and heartfelt second novel, Cascade Falls, which has just been published, it touches on this question. Now, prior to becoming a novelist, Bruce built a long and successful career as a television comedy writer and producer. He's a multiple Emmy and Golden Globe nominee, and his credits include Bosom Buddies, Growing Pains, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Coach, and Home Improvement, where he served as executive producer and showrunner. Now, in addition to being recognized by the Television Academy, Ferber's work has received the People's Choice, the Kids' Choice, and the Environmental Media Awards. Now, after his debut novel, Elevating Overman, garnered many favorable reviews, Ferber toured extensively, culminating in his delivering the closing keynote speech at the Irma Bombeck Writers' Workshop. Now, Elevating Overman was recently released on audiobook, and it was recorded by Jason Alexander. And for those that don't know who Jason Alexander is, you should be able to remember him, from the Seinfeld show. Elevating Overman is also being developed for the big screen. Now, Cascade Falls is now available, and it has just been released, so it's available in stores and online, and will be followed by another nationwide tour. Now, I have just learned that Bruce lives right here in Southern California with his wife, his large dog, and assorted musical instruments. And it sounds like there's a couple of questions in regards to that as well. Bruce, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. Great to be here.
Well, I am so glad to have you on. And as we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, I am at that stage in my life where I am learning that the most difficult thing to write is comedy. And obviously you did it, and you did it quite well. So tell me, how does someone who has gone to writing what's probably the most difficult thing to write and decide that he's now going to start writing novels and going into much greater detail about topics rather than the type of thing that you can do in a soundbite on a TV sitcom?
Well, the answer, Alan, is I've gone from something difficult to something more difficult. So the answer is I'm a masochist. And the reason I say that is that, well, it's true that not everybody is funny. I mean, you kind of know if you're funny, like, as you're growing up. And whether you can write funny or not is a whole other story. I think if you're not a funny person, you're never going to be able to write funny. If you're a funny person, you still might not be able to write funny. You just don't know quite how to do it. And there are some people who say, well, you can't learn how to be funny. And that's possibly true. But if you have a funny bone, you can learn how to put it on the page. So that's kind of what I did. And then once I became successful and working regularly in television, I began to work on sitcoms, which have a writing staff. So you have anywhere from 6 to 18 people on some of these shows in a room collaborating, trying to get the funniest jokes and the funniest situations possible. And with a whole bunch of people in the room, you know, who are talented, you can get it done in not that great amount of time. I mean, you have to put a show out every single week. When you go to writing novels, it's just you. It's just you in the room by yourself. And sometimes, Alan, you get really sick of the company. And I know I have. And there you are. You're there with yourself and this subconscious. And you've got the voice that wants to write the material and the voice in the back of your head saying, who am I kidding? Can I really do this? And it's a constant struggle to let the pure side, to let the voice win.
Well, now tell us, how did this voice get you to go from television comedy writer to the failed promise of the American dream? I mean, it seems like a pretty weighty topic to jump to.
It's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess as far as the American dream went and all of this, it all kind of was born gradually. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was working in television, you know, I had a good career. I was going from show to show. I got married. I had kids. I bought a house. And everything was going great. And then one day, I found myself on the sitcom From Hell, where all the writers were kept there till 3 in the morning every day because the person who was the showrunner, the head writer, executive producer, had no personal life. So we were the entertainment, and we were there, and they never wanted to go home. And at one point, one of the other writers turned to me. He was so frustrated. We were all so frustrated. He turned to me and said, Bruce, I want you to go to the parking lot, get in your car, drive it through this wall, and run me over. And I said, only if you guarantee that I die in the process. It was that miserable. Luckily, that show was soon canceled, and we both went on to bigger and better things. But that feeling of being, you know, not being able to quit because I had a mortgage and a family, and just being miserable but feeling stuck, that feeling stayed with me. So cut to many, many years later, you know, I'm at the computer, I'm Googling around, and, you know, suddenly I remember that show and remember that job that I hated so much. And, you know, you constantly hear people complaining about their work. And I just started to Google, you know, what percentage of people in America hate what they do. And the result was, it was staggering. It was 81%. 81% of people in this country hate how they spend 40-plus hours a week of their lives. And, you know, it got me to thinking, how can you live the American dream if you're miserable, you know, for your working and most of your waking life? And that's how this idea was kind of born.
Well, and that's a great point, because when we talk about the American dream, you know, we didn't dream that we were going to be doing something that we would hate. We didn't dream that we would be doing something that we would think of as drudgery, you know, or something that would, you know, spike our stress level to the point that, you know, that we're starting to go to the cardiologist to get our heart checked.
And my point is that we've been sold a bill of goods that to live the American dream, you have to own a home. And, you know, at what price does that come is part of what this book is about. And the real estate market is a big part of this book. And just what people think they have to do. I don't know if you remember this, but the big boom out in Lancaster and Palmdale, you remember when that all happened?
Yes.
The big housing boom? Mm-hmm. And it was generated by people feeling that if they didn't own their own home, that they were doing something wrong. So all these people who were living in L.A. bought in Lancaster and Palmdale, and there's, I guess, one road that goes in and out of there, and suddenly they were commuting 2 hours each way.
Right.
And there were people who just abandoned their houses because they couldn't deal with it. They couldn't deal with it. And they, why did they buy in? They bought in because they wanted a piece of what supposedly was the American dream.
Right, and it was an American dream that was being created out there by marketing people. You know, I mean, you know, it's the, you know, this is the American dream. You need to have a piece of this. If you don't have a piece of this, there's something wrong with you. And we had the same thing. I'm in Orange County, and the same thing here, only it was out in Riverside in San Bernardino. So,
right.
You know, you had both sides of L.A., with all of these homes, and then when the bubble burst, as you said, people abandoned those homes, and they got hit with the worst, you know, property losses,
right,
than nearly anywhere in California.
Right.
So
you know, and when that happens to people, I mean, let's say you don't even go through the bust, but you got a mortgage that's really big, and you don't feel like you have any way out. You know, what kind of person are you when you come home at night? How are you going to be there for your wife? How are you going to be there for your family? How are you going to be excited to sit down with them at dinner time? And it's a struggle, and I think it's a struggle that people don't acknowledge. They feel that everybody, you're supposed to get home, you're supposed to turn it off, and you're supposed to be Mr. Happy and just, you know, be able to integrate. And I think that we need to examine and acknowledge just how difficult that is, and it needs to be talked about, and, you know, marriages need work based on this, I think.
Yeah, and I think you in the book, you know, you go a lot into the connection between that and the, you know, the frayed relationships. You go into the marital, you know, the father son. So I mean, is that how you see it? You think that sort of the dysfunction that you've created in Cascade Falls is sort of a picture of what we're going through in this country?
I do. I think it's kind of a, you know, a microcosm. I think some people can manage it better than others. But, you know, if you look at the divorce rates and you look at the enormous sales of self-help books, everybody is looking for the fix. And, you know, people you talk to every day, you know, nobody seems happy. I mean, not nobody, but a real good percentage of them do not seem happy. And, you know, we've been programmed to think that this is all okay. And we just really have to step back and examine what we do and kind of the financial situations we put ourselves in as well.
Right. Yeah, and it's the thing about, you know, jumping on the wheel, you know, of the rat race, and it keeps going and going and going, and then you're realizing, I don't know how to get off.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, as in the book in Cascade Falls, characters, you know, go to some extreme measures, and they everybody in this book, Cascade Falls, like a lot of us in life, we want to do the right thing. And sometimes we feel so much pressure by what's going on in our work, it's just that we're not happy, that we don't always do the right thing. And it doesn't mean that we're bad human beings. It means that we're flawed, and that there are things about what our society has become that we have to acknowledge. And then by examining those things, I think we can still take responsibility for ourselves, but not blame ourselves for being inadequate.
Well, and one of the things that I think you've done with the book, and you mentioned about now, you know, the sales of self-help books and stuff, that I think that there's an aspect of self-help, but you've used the power of story, so that there's this wonderful story, and that I think as somebody reads it, you can see that maybe that's a little bit of me, or maybe that's a little bit of my brother, or my aunt, my uncle, my best friend, or whatever. And I think that's part of the beauty of it, you know, is the fact that I think that it can be something to where you go, you know, I think I've just gained a lot therapeutically from this, but I did it through the power of story rather than a to-do list.
Yeah, and you know, for me writing this book, obviously there's a lot of me in this book. There's one part of the book you know, I unfortunately experienced the death of a spouse. My first wife died from breast cancer, and she was a voracious reader. And after she died, she left me with shelves and shelves of books that it will take me the rest of my life to read. And at one point, as I started writing one of the characters in Cascade Falls, I had the character take one of the books that his late wife, he also had a wife who died, and he takes one of the books off the shelves, and he's fascinated by this, and he realizes that while his wife is no longer there, he's going to try and read a lot of these books and gain insight into his spouse, who's gone, through the books that she loved.
That's great.
And, you know, I don't know whether other people can relate to that, but it was something that just occurred to me. And it happened to me because there was one particular book that I read that was just so moving to me. And, of course, I would have liked to have talked with my wife about it, but not being able to do that, it was still really interesting to read the book and kind of dissect what it was about that book that might have moved her.
Yeah, I like that story, and I like the fact that that's probably something that, you know, there is somebody else out there that, you know, in a similar situation that looks at that, and it touches them, you know, in a very special way as well, which, again, that's why I said I like the concept of the fact that there are so many different characters, that there's something that's going to touch someone. You know, we've got a listener question that is okay. Is coming in through instant message. Let me read this. It says, we have put three children through college. Only one is actively engaged in the career path that relates to his degree, which is aerospace engineering, and he loves his life. The other two have been unable to achieve this, and they are in jobs that solely pay the bills and support their families. Reading the review of your book hit me so hard, as I really would love to see a different outcome for them. I'm looking for some powerful messages to impart. My question, is your book one that tells a life tale with humor, or one that also inspires readers to examine their lives and find the courage to not just settle and give up, but forge new paths to fulfilling their dreams?
You know, I think it does, but it does in realistic and small ways. This is not a book that, you know, you're going to see characters, you know, just make huge reversals and suddenly, you know, be enormous successes. Because I try to make it a little more like life, that things like that don't happen overnight. But what you see in this book, you see people in the face of hardship make choices and really work hard to keep a family together and to discover what at least is going to make them passionate about what they do, to find their passion. And, you know, I would not say that this is like a feel-good romp by any stretch of the imagination, but I think by digging deeper and getting into the complexities of it, and to know that we're not alone, is helpful.
Well, it sounds like what you've done, and now going back and comparing to your life in television. In television, you had to, in a matter of 22 minutes, you had to go so over the top to make sure that everybody saw that message. And it now, if I understand what you're saying, you've really sort of backed off and come to a level that is far more realistic in the sense of how things happen in real life. It doesn't happen in 22 minutes. You know, it actually takes some time, and you don't always make it the first time.
Right, and in answer to the listener, I mean, it's like my feeling is that, you know, lots of people are stuck in jobs that they don't like. But as long as they know that, and as long as they can, you know, keep a sense of self and keep thinking about what it is they're passionate about. You know, realistically, they may never be able to earn a living doing the things they're passionate about. Look, I mean, novelists, you know, most novelists don't make any money, but people do it because they do it in their off hours, whatever they do. They do it because they need to express their passion. And, you know, in some cases, yes, you may have a job you don't like for the rest of your life, but you may write a brilliant novel, you know? And these are things that we always have to keep conscious of, that the bad job that we hate does not define who we are as people.
So what would you tell these parents in what they can tell their now two college, I guess, recent college graduates on how they can feel as good as possible about what they're doing? You know, what would you?
Well, first of all, people have to know just how hard it is out there. I mean, I have a friend whose wife is a lawyer who can't get a job because there's a gut glut of lawyers. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if everybody can kind of recognize that we live in difficult times, and the last thing you want to do is have your children feel like a failure. I mean, that's what it's really about. You know, just because they're not in their dream jobs doesn't mean they failed. And whatever it is about them that exists apart from their job should be encouraged and nurtured.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think you never know where you're going to land, because, you know, if you can stay positive and stay hopeful, you may run into somebody at a party sometime who could set you on a path that you never anticipated.
Right, so what you're saying, yeah, is don't give up. You know, do the other job that makes the money and pays the bills, but continue to pursue that passion, so that people will recognize it.
Right. In my book, I have a character who feels terrible about himself because he's in a job like that, and that's because he's letting his job define who he is. You know, and that has its good. And, you know, I remember when I was doing sitcoms, there were a lot of people who were doing very well, very successful writer-producers, and they let themselves be defined by their jobs. And then, as the whole sitcom phenomenon started to wane and they found themselves not working, they were absolutely a wreck. They didn't know who they were anymore because they were not that person.
Okay. Well, you mentioned about the sitcoms, and I have been patiently waiting to talk a little bit about Home Improvement, because that was one of the shows that I made it a point to watch all the time. It's one that I enjoyed. It must have come out at a time in which, you know, I was the demographic. So tell me a little bit about, you know, about that show, about your happiness in regards to writing, producing. Tell us, you know, walk the audience through a little bit about what it's like to be sort of behind the scenes on a hit show like that.
Well, first of all, there is, you know, the phenomenon of joining a show that's already been on the air. Home Improvement was on the air for 2 years when I had joined it. And, you know, every show has its own sort of peculiarities, the ins and outs of how to write the show, what the star likes, what he doesn't like. It's really a learning curve because, especially with a guy like Tim Allen. Tim Allen came up with the concept, you know, based on his stand-up act, and a lot of it he wanted based on his life. He grew up in Michigan, and so the show took place in Michigan. He was making references to things that happened in Michigan, colleges in Michigan, and you kind of had to learn that whole milieu for what it was. And you also had to learn what Tim liked. It was very odd in the beginning. We had come up with a story where one of the kids caught a foul ball at a baseball game. And we pitched the story to Tim, and Tim didn't want to do it. And we said, well, why not? He says, well, you know, I don't really like baseball. And we said, could your character like baseball? Because we figured this is a Midwest dad, whatever. He said, no, if I don't like baseball, the character can't like baseball. So we didn't do the story.
Oh, interesting.
So there are things like that that you're dealing with. And then there are also, I mean, Home Improvement was kind of a magical show because Tim was so funny. And, you know, we could write great stuff for him. And then he'd go off and, you know, improv on it and make it funnier. And sometimes the audience loved this guy so much that things would happen that you could not even predict would happen. When we shot the show, the writers, producers, we would be in the director's booth with the director, and the actors are out on the stage with an audience in front of them. And there was one time we were doing a show, the show within the show, remember the Tool Time part of the show, and they were doing a thing on door locks, you know, putting locks on your home, right? And so they were talking about door locks. They were talking about, you know, you have your police locks, you have your deadbolt locks, and then we wrote a line, you have your bagels and locks. And then Tim, in front of the audience, starts doing like this whole riff on bagels and locks for about a minute. And he's just going on and on and on. And so after that take, you know, we tell him to like tone it down because a little locks goes a long way. And then, so he does the scene again in front of the audience, and he says, you know, you got your police locks, your deadbolt locks, your bagels and locks, and only use a little locks because a little locks goes a long way. He thought it was a line of dialogue. We were giving him a stage direction. He thought it was a line of dialogue, and when he said a little locks goes a long way, he got a huge laugh. And we said, we might as well not even write the show anymore because we don't even know what, whatever he says is getting a laugh.
Well, now we're gonna take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the book. And again, for those out there that are listening, the book is called Cascade Falls. We are talking with Bruce Ferber, and stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking about author Bruce Ferber's second novel, Cascade Falls, and it literally talks about the American dream, or maybe not always achieving the American dream, and what people do sometimes in trying to do the right thing that doesn't always work out that way. Now, Bruce, I know you mentioned earlier that, I mean, obviously you had a huge change in your life, you know, in losing your wife. Share with us a little bit, because I know that many of the listeners that we have, some of the family members, they talk about they went through a loss and it really changed their outlook on life. Did going through that, is that what really kind of made you reevaluate the direction you were headed career-wise?
Yeah, I mean, it, first of all, I, you know, practically speaking, I wanted to stop working for a while to take care of my wife when she was sick. And then somewhere around that time was when I just, I felt, you know, and I was a fortunate guy in the sense, work-wise, that I could afford to take off for a while, and I just, it was very hard for me to think about sitcoms while she was sick. And then, you know, there was this one sort of crystallizing moment where I was trying to sell a new show, a pilot, to one of the networks, and I'm, you know, pitching like the 10,000th version of Friends, because those are the kind of shows that everybody wanted. And, you know, I hear the words coming out of my mouth, and my wife is sick at home, and I said, forget it, I can't do this anymore. And so, obviously, I wanted to be back and taking care of her. But also, this kind of switch went on that said, I really want out. I really don't want to do this anymore. And then after Janice passed away, I had to figure out, what am I going to do with myself? Because, you know, I was in my early 50s and, you know, pretty much at my creating prime, I felt. But if I wasn't going to write sitcoms, what was I going to do? And that's how I got around to writing my first novel.
Now, did at that point in time, becoming a single parent, did that kind of change the your outlook on life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, listen, you know, everybody who's been through this knows that when your child loses a parent, you know, you're going to be both mother and, you got to be mother and father to your kids at that point. You got to, and you're always going through life thinking, what would she have done here? You know, because parenting is really difficult anyway, and even if two of you are there, you don't always have the right answer. So if there's a problem that comes up, you know, I'm trying to think for both of us, and that's what happened to me. And, you know, in a way, it gave me great focus and great purpose. Not that I didn't have it before, but, you know, the raising of children is, you know, a far greater purpose than going in and writing jokes for a living, obviously.
Now, and you brought up something that I think is really important, and that is you focused on what the children are going through now, having lost a parent. And I think the human nature is, that we hear from many people, is they're focused more on what they are going through after losing a spouse. You know, share with us a little bit about that, because I think that that's an important point, you know, where your focus went and how it immediately went to them and kind of what they needed at that moment.
I really think that happens automatically, that for most people, I don't know, I can only speak for myself. You know, the first thing that you think of when you watch children go through this is you think, well, they did not deserve this. They deserve to have two parents, you know, for a good long time in their lives. And so it just, for me, it was just an automatic thing, the button that got pushed. And, you know, I'll share with you a really, perhaps it's uniquely Los Angeles, I don't really know, but, you know, this is what my focus was on my kids. 2 weeks after my wife passed away, I'm walking my dog, and my neighbor, his car stops, and he's got a girlfriend at the time, and she lowers her window, and she says to me, as soon as you're ready, I have the perfect person for you. This is two weeks after my wife's death. And added on to that, I didn't even know this person very well. And I really said to her, I said, you know, I was just honest. I had no filter because I was just so raw. I was so raw. Mm-hmm. I said, listen, you know, you don't even know me. How do you know who's perfect for me? And she said, oh, I know. This is a great person. And, you know, it occurred to me at that point that there are all these women going around who are, for lack of a better word, pimping for their divorced friends. And if you're a man and you have a pulse and you're not a serial killer, you know, they're coming after you.
And you have a job.
And you have a job. But, you know, of course, that was not my focus at all. I was interested in my kids, and I was really, really offended by even hearing that, certainly at 2 weeks in.
Wow. Yeah. I wish I could say that I'm surprised, but but I live here too, so I can certainly see that happening. How long did it take to where you were able to kind of focus on you and start you know, looking at yourself and where you were going to go with your own life, your own relationships, and so on?
Well, you know, as far as my own life and work and things like that, that just sort of slowly, you know, began to emerge when I started, when my daughter was in her first year of college. She was away. My son was going to college locally at Northridge. And, you know, when he was off at school, I had plenty of time to think. And I realized that I had to fill my time while he was gone. And that's where the work thing came. And as far as the other part went, I never actually dated anybody. Well, I did. I mean, I did date somebody, but I never went through that thing of the internet dating and all of that. We have a kind of another condo up in the Ventura area, and there was a woman living next door to us who my wife knew, and we didn't know her that well. She was our next door neighbor. She used to come over when we had barbecues and stuff, but we didn't really know each other very well. And I held on to that place because it was sort of my weekend refuge.
Uh-huh.
And she and I began to sort of hang out with each other, and eventually it worked out, and now we're married.
Well, congratulations.
So my and that happened, you know, we started to see each other a couple of years after my wife passed away, and it all came together. I was a lucky person.
So it sounds like you are currently happy, or at least happier than the residents of Cascade Falls. You know, how do you compare some of those families? And you say that you know, that part of it is you. You know, is there a little bit of you in each character, or are there some characters that are a little bit more? How did you make some of those determinations?
Well, you know, obviously the characters come from me, and it just sort of, I don't know. I mean, with the main characters, they're just sort of expressing things that you have lived or seen your wife live, or, you know, it just sort of came out organically. There's a major character in there, who is Ted, who's the real estate developer, who's really not me, but he's based on, you know, some of the people that I've known along the way, you know, small businessmen. And then there is the writer who's writing a biography on him, and that idea came from learning that there was a real estate developer in Arizona who had somebody actually do this, write a biography of him, which struck me as like a really hilarious idea. And then when I came up with the character, I thought, well, who's going to write this biography? And it really hit me that it would be very funny to have somebody who was at one point a really well-respected writer, albeit a character like a Hunter Thompson type of writer,
yeah,
who was down on his luck and would just write anything for money. And that's who writes Ted's biography.
Exactly. And I appreciate you sharing. I've been purposely kind of not wanting to give too much away in regards to the book. And by the way, if anybody would like to follow along with us a little bit, you can go to Bruce's website. He's got some information on the website as well, not only about this one, but also about Elevating Overman, his first novel, and that is very simply BruceFerber.net. It's F-E-R-B-E-R. So that's BruceFerber.net. You can go and you can follow along. Obviously, for those of you out there driving, don't try this. But everybody else, if you're sitting at your computer, you can pull up another window, continue to listen to us. But also, in fact, if you click on About, you'll be able to even see a picture of Bruce. You'll be able to see who you're listening to. So anyway, we've got actually another comment that's coming in, and this one sounds like a fan. This one says, Home Improvement is one of my all-time favorite shows, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. Thankfully, my teens don't actually understand what the American Dream actually meant to our generation. As a family, we are into sustainability, new energy, gardening, etc. I am hopeful my two teens will continue the journey into a healthier lifestyle, and that the old version of the American Dream will disappear into history and be replaced with something much, much more.
That's beautiful. I love that.
And again, we appreciate any of the comments that come in. For those of you, if you have comments, you have questions, if you send them in, they either come through email, through instant message, or we can take calls, although people have realized that when I'm remote like this, taking calls sometimes doesn't work out real well. it's not my first my first job as far as understanding how to push all the right buttons and not lose people. Bruce, tell us what is next. What is coming up next? What can people expect from you in the near future?
Well, first off, I'm going to try and get out there with Cascade Falls and do a bunch of book events. I'm doing them all over LA. So if you go to my website, there's actually four in Southern California. There's one in Santa Monica next Thursday. There's one at Book Soup on April 1st. There's one in Huntington Beach. No, there's one in Ventura April 4th and Huntington Beach April 8th. And then I'm going to go to other places with the book and, get it out there and try and promote what I spent so many years working on. So that's the number one thing for now. And then I've got a couple of other ideas for books. And so there'll be another novel eventually. And hopefully, we can get Overman made as a movie. And that would be great.
Now, you mentioned April 8th in Huntington Beach. If I am in town, and at this point I believe I'm going to be, I'd love to stop by and see you there. So if anybody is out
there. Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, the Barnes & Noble, do you know it?
I know exactly where it is. It's in Belaterra. So
yes.
For any of those people out here that are close by, what time is that one?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. All right. So for everybody, you can go out there. You can either catch an early dinner. You can go next door to the Cheesecake Factory or one of the other nice restaurants right there. Either catch an early dinner or, if you're going to eat a little bit later, go by, meet Bruce and get a copy of the book and grab a bite to eat afterwards.
I'd love to meet everybody because I really appreciate who your listenership is, and that last comment I thought was absolutely right on. I mean, that I would hope for an American Dream like that.
Well, you and me both. So now you mentioned it in regards to Overman. Tell everybody a little bit about that again for those that don't know or that didn't hear earlier. Cascade Falls is your second novel. I know that that Overman has actually won some awards. Tell us a little bit about that one in case anybody's interested there as well.
Well, Overman, it's actually kind of interesting because the whole thing plays into how I became a novelist in the first place, which was somebody asked me, like, have you ever thought of writing a novel? I mean, it was like as simple as that. I went, oh, I could never write a novel, you know. I'm a television guy and this and this and that. But I knew I didn't want to get back into television. So one of those days when my kid is off at college and I'm sitting around, I start to write this character, Ira Overman, who's a guy who's in his 50s. And he wasn't exactly like me in that I had had success and he had never had success. And he was kind of a loser character. But he was looking for kind of a second act in his life, something that would be meaningful. And he just wanted to make a change in his life. And what he did was, you know, he was just looking, you know, what do I do? Small thing, big thing. And then one day, so I wrote this character, I wrote 3 pages of this character, and I had fun doing it. And one day I went to my mailbox, and I found the Penny Saver, and there was an ad that said, life-changing LASIK surgery, $299 an eye. And I thought, this is my book. This is the springboard for the whole book. And I went back, and I wrote that Ira Overman decides that, you know, one small thing he could do in his life is, you know, get rid of the glasses and see better. And So he does that. And then what happens is, not only does he see better, he sees the whole world differently, and his entire life changes as a result of it.
Excellent. You want to give us any more little teasers? It's interesting. As you were telling me, I started sort of seeing a little bit of Better Call Saul or something.
Well, yeah, it has, you know, elements of that. And also, what happens is that Overman has been a loser his whole life. And once he has the LASIK surgery and he sees the world better, and it gives him more confidence. And once he gets more confidence, he starts doing things he was never able to do before. And he has a best friend who's his sidekick, who is an expert in the field of comic books, and finds himself starting to believe that Overman has now gotten superpowers. And it's really a very funny relationship, and I would say that book, you know, of the two books, it's the bigger comedy of the two books, and it's a fun read. What can I tell you?
Yeah. I'm a very visual person, so I start seeing, and obviously coming from the television era, you know, as you're telling me, again, I saw a little bit of Better Call Saul, and then I started, you're mentioning the glasses, and I'm sort of seeing, sort of a Clark Kent Superman kind of thing, you know, where, you know, all of a sudden when he doesn't have this renewed confidence, and there's even a little bit of George from Seinfeld.
Yes. And Jason did the narration for the audiobook, which was perfect. But just to give you another little sneak peek in that one, Overman works as a car salesman, so that when he goes to get his eye surgery done, he starts negotiating with the doctor, because that's what you do as a car salesman.
All right. Well, I tell you, Bruce, I have appreciated you taking this time. So glad to have you on the show. And I would look forward to also seeing you on April 8th. And again, for anybody out there, if you go to the website, again, bruceferber.net, you can get the information where his tour is going to be. So go out there, check out the book. Bruce, keep writing, and we appreciate what you're doing.
You too, Alan. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right. For everybody out there, thank you for listening to Answers for the Family. Be with us again next week when we will be back and continuing to bring you answers to help make your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.